part of the kind of lectures on the background materials for our invited lecturers start coming. Next week will be David Wallace and the Many Worlds Interpretation. At the end of this lecture, I will give some recommended reading so you can get up to speed and follow his lectures as closely as possible. So with last week's lecture, we talked about issues that arose surrounding measurement in quantum mechanics, and what we found is that we needed this independent postulate from unitary evolution, what we call a projection postulate. In particular, we could divide it up into two cases, one with post-selection and one without post-selection. So without post-selection means we describe a set of systems that we get after the measurement without subdividing them according to the outcome obtained. And that was described by a mixture of the projectors of the eigenstate to be observable. We applied post-selection, though we were left in an eigenstate associated with corresponding to the eigenvector corresponding to the observable obtained. And we noted that this transformation could not be represented by a unitary transformation on any extended Hilbert space. And in this sense, decoherence, which is often kind of misconstrued to explain away the measurement problem, does not explain the existence of that transformation. And that transformation is problematic. It's not clear when it's supposed to occur, how we can understand it in any kind of physical or dynamical sense. We concluded that a natural way to avoid that problem was to think of quantum states as not being complete. But then we didn't have to imagine this transformation as being a physical transformation, corresponding to the update of one's information, just like when we change our probability assignments to some classical system. It's not a physical transformation, it's an update of our own personal scheme for keeping track of what's going on and making predictions. So today we're going to start by discussing another reason for thinking that quantum states are incomplete, which was proposed by Einstein. Now this almost looks like a joke, but this is an actual article title in the New York Times. Einstein attacks quantum theory. Scientists and two colleagues find that it's not complete even though correct. So what is this article about? Well, it's about the EP argument against completeness. So the paper, which is obviously one of the more famous papers of the century, is entitled, Can the Quantum Mechanical Description of Reality Be Considered Complete? And it's by Isaac Goldstein and Rosen, and was published in 1935. The approach they took was to first lay out what do we mean by things like real and what do we mean by things like disturbance. So what they proposed was a necessary condition for something to be real. And their exact wording is every element of physical reality, a necessary condition for something to be real in a theory. Let me start again. For a completeness of a theory. So the reality condition is second. So the first condition was completeness. And a necessary condition for that is that every element of the physical theory must have a counterpart. Every element of physical reality must have a counterpart in the physical theory. That's David Wallace's theory. So they emphasize this is not a sufficient condition for completeness, and there can be other criteria that might be satisfied if this is a necessary condition. So that seems innocent enough. And then the second assumption is a sufficient condition for physical reality of some quantity. And there they lay out specifically that if, without in any way disturbing the system, you can predict with certainty, i.e. the probability of the unity, the value of the physical quantity, then there exists an element of physical reality corresponding to this physical quantity. And I'll again emphasize this is not a necessary condition for reality, it's just a sufficient one. So that seems fair enough. The next step is to observe that if we do a standard quantum mechanical treatment, we note that quantum mechanical states do not allow simultaneous specification of values of non-commutative observables. From this fact, EPR concluded there was one of two possibilities. Either one, the quantum mechanical description of reality given by the wave function is not complete, or two, when the operators corresponding to two physical quantities do not commute, the two quantities cannot have simultaneous reality. So this would be more along the lines of Bohr's view also the Orthodox, by no means Iraqi, you. We can't assign definite properties to some observables. And as I mentioned, both of these were appreciated by von Neumann, who explicitly endorsed two and rejected one, presumably mainly on account of his no-go theorem for invariables, which I'll discuss in about an hour. So EPR, on the other hand, from their argument, concluded that one should be endorsed, quantum states are not complete, and two rejected. So the analysis goes like this. Well, the actual EPR paper considered eigenstate, a joint eigenstate of the two particle system involving the total momentum, linear momentum, and the relative position. So the analysis in that case is a little bit complicated, not to mention the delta function state, which has its own associated issues. So we're going to consider a simpler model system devised by Bohm involving two spin half particles, and that generalizes later the Bell's theorem. And so basically, the analysis by Bohm, which has the same conceptual features, is to consider a singlet state of these two particles. So here, we can consider these bases to be the eigenstates along some axis, like the z-axis. So the plus state on the first particle denotes that that particle we found to have spin up along the z-axis, and similarly for the second particle, where the minus sign denotes finding the spin and spin down. Now, the state has a zero total angular momentum, so the spins are anti-correlated. So if you find spin 1 to be up, we have to find spin 2 to be down. As a condition implied by the state. Now, the key assumption here, which I put in a separate sentence, is that we have to assume that after the state preparation has occurred, the two particles can no longer interact. They do not interact. And then we make a few very trivial observations. We note that if we measure particle 1 along, say, the z-axis, and we get plus h bar over 2 in that particle, then from measurement of particle 2, we have to get minus h bar over 2 if we measure along the same axis, and vice versa. But now, instead of measuring sz, we can measure sx. So we have two people, one holding particle 1, who measures sx, and that person can predict that if the other person measures particle 2 and measures xx, they'll get the opposite result. So depending on the measurement performed by the first person, they can predict with certainty the outcome of a measurement performed by the second person along the same axis. So that's completely trivial. There's nothing deep or hidden there. This is all very simple. So it follows that we can predict with certainty the outcomes of measurements of either Sx or Sz of the second particle when we possess the first particle and perform either an Sx or an Sz measurement. And we can do this without in any way disturbing the second system. So we can imagine the two systems far apart. I measure my particle along some axis. I can predict with certainty the outcome of the other particle along that same axis. So by the criteria of reality proposed by EPR, there must be elements of reality corresponding to both Sx and Sz, because I've predicted either one without disturbing that second system. So actually, this next paragraph is a nice summary of, not a nice summary. Okay, for some reason, EPR go in this convoluted analysis where they first negate option 2, that is that there cannot be simultaneous reality, and then they argue that the two options are jointly exhaustive, and then they're forced to conclude that the quantum mechanical description of physical reality is not complete, given by the wave function is not complete. In fact, I mean, it follows more or less directly the fact that we can be consistent Sx and Sz both have real properties implies the wave, and the wave function does not offer those properties, implies that it's not a complete description by these criteria. I think I say that a bit later. Now, in Bohm's paper, he emphasized a few facts that weren't emphasized in the EPR paper. Namely, that each element of physical reality must have a precisely defined counterpart in theory, which is slightly stronger. Also that it's meaningful to talk about the world in terms of separately existing elements of reality. That's an acceptable thing to do, and that's an explicit assumption. Bohm makes that an explicit assumption. So actually, let's get just kind of an historical anecdote. I found when I was doing some of the reading this weekend that in this paper, I mean, actually this was in Bohm's textbook. And he concludes after going through his revised version of the EPR paradox in terms of two spin half particles, he says, we can now use some of the results of the analysis of the paradox of EPR to help prove the quantum theory is inconsistent with the assumption of hidden causal variables. And then he argues from the apparent conflict with the uncertainty principle that's implied by the EPR analysis. And then he concludes that no theory of mechanically determined hidden variables can lead to all of the results of quantum theory. Now, this is very ironic, given that a year later, Bohm published his causal hidden variable interpretation, suggesting interpretation of quantum theory in terms of hidden variables. Yeah?
Can you clarify what Bohm's point four is? So this assumption that you have separately existing elements of reality, what does it mean? Does it mean that somehow the non-commutativity can also be real?
Now, I think he's referring to the fact that we have two separate systems. So that we can think of the world as decomposing into two systems, and then we can talk about one system independently of another system. So it's in contrast to this idea of kind of the intrinsic wholeness of the universe that Bohm talks about, that we can't speak about, if there's indivisible wholeness, and we can't talk about properties of one system independent of the other systems. So he brings that out. I think that's what he has in mind. Maybe Anthony has to.
In that case, it's a foundational assumption, since in the theory, I mean, the criterion for reality has to do with the theory, and the theory already assumes that the world is divisible.
The quantum theory.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at entangled states, then it's not entirely clear that the world is divisible in that way. In fact, that's what this question is. Does quantum theory allow that kind of separable description of assigning quantic values? So, we can make a few additional observations, and then we can maybe open up some discussion on this. So, just note that if the collapse of the wave function is presumed to be a physical process, as it I think must be on the assumption that the wave function is a complete description of the system's physical properties, because then the collapse process is a physical transformation. And the collapse must be an instantaneous change of physical properties throughout space. Now we recall that this is all very similar to von Neumann's analysis of the Compton experiment, where he deduced that if we intercept one particle, we measure its momentum, and we can immediately infer the momentum of the other particle, and therefore the state of the other particle has to collapse due to the associated eigenstate. And that this was operationally demanded for consistency with experimental outcomes. But what EPR really brings out is that this holds true even if the two systems are separated by a large space-like separation. And then there's obviously some kind of conflict there with our notion of locality and causality within the framework of the special relativity. And then another point just on language, this is just kind of my point, that EPR didn't really distinguish between quantum theory as mathematical formalism and the idea of an independent set of bridge principles that allows to interpret the theory. Which are really two separate things. I mean, one can preserve the mathematical structure and have different sets of correspondence rules that interpret it, or one can completely change the theory, of course. So when EPR argue about incompleteness of quantum theory, it's not entirely clear, especially in the case of Einstein, he meant that he thought the whole mathematical formalism had to go, or just the interpretation. I mean, it's clear at times just the interpretation, that the interpretation is problematic. It was also clear at other times that he thinks really the whole theory has to be kind of reconstructed from scratch to recover determinism. You know, a whole new theory is required, not just adding on a few different interpretation principles to the existing structure. So bear that in mind when we talk about Einstein.
Seems one thinks about relativity, there's a bit of a problem with the inverse sentence, isn't there? So much it would be in that instance.
Yeah, I didn't, I'm not careful with the language there.
I agree with that. I suppose I don't, like I said, even if you want something that works in the process, it works. You're really faced with a problem if you don't control that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, simultaneity is not well defined in this context. Actually, before we have more general discussion, maybe it's good to just talk about, just mention Born's response to the EPR, and then we'll turn to Bell's theorem, so that'll be a natural break. So Born's response, which it's difficult to make out exactly what we can get out of it, but he emphasizes that the finite interaction between the object and the measuring agencies, conditioned by the very existence of the quantum of action, entails, because of the impossibility of controlling the reaction of the object on the measuring instruments, if these are to serve the purpose, the necessity of a final renunciation of the classical ideal of causality and a radical revision of our attitude towards the problem of physical reality. While there is no question of a mechanical disturbance of the system under investigation, there is essentially the question of an influence on the very conditions which define the possible types of predictions regarding the future behavior of the system. And then, many years later, he said, recapitulating the impossibility of subdividing the individual quantum effects and separating the behavior of the objects from the interaction with the measuring instruments serving to define the conditions under which the phenomena appear implies an ambiguity in assigning conventional attributes to atomic objects, which calls for a reconsideration of our attitude towards the problem of physical explanation in this novel situation. Even the old question of an ultimate determinacy of natural, I hope there was a period in there somewhere that I missed. Even the old question of an ultimate determinacy of natural phenomena has lost its conceptual basis, and it is against this background that the viewpoint of complementarity presents itself as a rational generalization of the very ideal of causality. So clearly, Bohr was not convinced by the EPR analysis.
Do you understand this book?
No. First one? Well, I mean, maybe there's something to this in terms of the fact that you think about the fact that you need some kind of reference system by which to form any measurement, and that any measurement involves a disturbance of the reference system. That's some kind of implicit problem, but it's not really clear. One really has to read into it to get out any kind of quantitative rebuttal. Yeah.
So that's confusing, because with both paragraphs, the first half I can read as an argument for hidden variables. There is always something you cannot take into account, therefore there is some process that's responsible for this.
Yeah.
And then somehow the conclusion is that is what you have to deal with. There is no ultimate better description. So there is, in those paragraphs, there doesn't seem to be a link between the first half and the second.
I'm definitely not going to stand up here and defend Bohr for trying to interpret what he meant. But there is a certain prescience to what he's saying here. We'll study contextuality later in the class. That this emphasis on really keeping track of everything must be taken into account to talk about any kind of attribution of properties will come up. So there could be some depth there given the later developments that he's just not expressing clearly, or at least in the way that I understand. So next we're going to turn to the whole notion of incompleteness of hidden variables and non-locality. So are there any other questions about the thrust of the argument that EPR is making here and what the conclusion is? Well, there's a few other comments. So the EPR argument presumes implicitly a notion of separability. This came up in the question from 14. Separately existing elements of reality may be attributed to each system, and also a notion of independence, that it is possible to arrange things so that the elements of reality of one system cannot be influenced by the elements of reality of another system. It's separated from it. And the assumption of independence is seemingly well motivated by special relativity. Einstein later was more explicit about what he had in mind by this locality assumption. He says the real factual situation of the system S2 is independent of what is done with the system S1. It's spatially separated from the form. I think that's what we're starting with, something like, on this fact, it must absolutely hold firm. So he really didn't buy into this notion there was some way of disturbing a distant system. But ironically, or not, well, let's cross out the word ironically, this idea of locality, which was introduced by the EPR argument, it was really just a tool to prove incompleteness. But in hindsight, it's probably the most important part of the theorem, or of the paradox, depending on how you look at it, which is that it brought into view the question of locality within the context of quantum mechanics. And John Bell devised a way to test directly for the existence of locality in quantum theory, or whether quantum theory satisfied it. They did this by developing kind of an arbitrary local realistic theory and determining some constraints on it. Yeah?
I get confused at this point by the meaning of the word that people are using. When they say locality, it seems to me that they're saying something slightly different, which I would expect from relativistic causality.
Yeah.
I just wonder if you can comment. I mean, for myself, I've devised locality.
Well, people use the distinction weak locality and strong locality.
Locality, to me, locality means something that you don't get access to. Just that sort of effects don't jump over reason and space and time. Some effect occurs by something that not some actual physical thing propagates from one point to another. But in itself, that wouldn't tell you whether this propagating object went faster than light or slower than light. So if you had something like quote unquote vacuum, you could imagine effects influencing space like separated substance. But you would need another hidden variable, you would need some actual object. So you could have this kind of, you know, things like separated measures could be influencing each other consistent with locality, but not consistent with causality, which would be the statement that that doesn't happen. Things only influence the future. Conversely, you can imagine things that are causal, but non-local, since they jump over the regions of space-time, but it's only timeline or non-direct. So what is it, I mean, I think that what's really going into this argument is what I, in that terminology, called causality.
This notion is called causality. So that's the causality. Whatever is done to create a causal influence, and that is called the normal analysis.
They went and used the word locality in the sense.
Yeah.
Well, this is how we define this notion of locality. It's that the factual, the physical properties can't be affected. So that implies a kind of causality. But,
So, can you just give an example of causality which is not locality?
Yes. And one can imagine such a thing. But you do something here, and the effect is felt later on. It's a timeline somewhere in the future of this, but there's no object or field that's modified in the intervening region. So in fact,
so it's like a causal action.
Yeah, in fact, I think if someone was an operationalist in a very strong sense, I would say their idea of quantum mechanics is precisely like this, because you do some preparations, say in this case, prepare the single state, then you do some measurements. But you don't say something was in between, because you deny reality, or you're at least neutral on the question of whether there's any reality to the particles that propagate, or whether there were particles. So that would be an example of something that's causal without being local. If you give up reality only to the instrument reading, there were no instrument readings in between that carried the information.
Well, it's hard to kind of reconstruct what it was specifically that I kind of objected to, this kind of refined distinction. But
I'm just asking you for the purpose of this discussion. When you say, look, are you defining locality to mean precisely the statement that effects don't propagate outside the light cone? Two straight line separated regions, something not in one region can't influence.
Well, I think you can use that as a justification of the independence assumption we need. I mean, one can appeal to that notion as a means of justifying the fact that systems aren't causally affecting each other. But I don't know if you're restricted to appealing to that.
And just in terms of what makes sense for both, presumably the implicit assumption of Einstein is things don't go past the line, things which are going to challenge. But I mean, if you assume that Einstein means that, then locality implies causality, and the two notions, you're right, they don't fit together because you've got this possibility of temporal distance, but ignoring that, and the separation of the notion becomes quite small once you simply suppose, rightly or wrongly, that relativity means no faster than signal, but no faster than half.
So, I mean, yeah, I don't know how to deal with these nuanced situations in this context that require a system.
Well, I just, for purposes of this discussion, but locality won't mean.
Well, it means exactly this for purposes of this discussion. Actually, we'll have a mathematical statement of the condition when we talk about Bell's theorem. Maybe that'll be clearer. So, so let's turn to how Bell made something quantitative out of this. But first, let's talk about this whole notion of independent variables. So the idea of incompleteness, which is at the heart of this discussion, is more or less directly connected to the idea that there are hidden variables which can be specified, which would determine the outcomes of measurements in quantum mechanics. Typically, it's presumed to be in a complete way. So these are things called hidden variables or hidden coordinates. There is additional parameters which we don't specify for now. So this possibility was considered and rejected by von Neumann back in 1932, producing a possibility proof. The possibility proof, it's a bit hard to make out all the assumptions, but some of them, some subset of them I've brought up here, which is first that these require hidden variables which will completely specify the outcomes of experiments. He calls these dispersion-free states. So in other words, the value assignments have no variance as do the quantum states via the Robertson inequality. Secondly, he assumes that every operator every operator had to have a hidden value assignment that predicted its outcome. Secondly, the hidden value assignment had to be one of its eigenvalues, which is reasonable given that when we do the experiment, we get an outcome that's one of the eigenvalues. This third assumption, which is the one that draws the criticism, is that for any operator which can be constructed as a linear combination to other Hermitian operators, that are not in general non-commuting even. The hidden value assignment for the operator C has to satisfy the same linear combination of the hidden value assignments for the operators A and B that are used, the same linear combinations used to define the operator. So why is it problematic? Well, first of all, operators A and B, if they're non-commuting, correspond to different types of experimental measurements, so incompatible experimental measurements. So let's see how this fails. The third assumption is directly incompatible with the first and second. So think about the Pauli operators. We can think about the Pauli operator along the x-axis, along the y-axis, and then define another Pauli operator, which is along the kind of vector between them, along the n direction. Now, for any Pauli operator, the eigenvalues are always plus or minus 1. But the eigenvalues of sigma n now have to be expressed as the linear combination 1 over square root of 2, plus or minus 1, plus or minus 1, which is obviously impossible. So it's impossible to construct a hidden variable theory that satisfies these conditions. So von Neumann concluded that hidden variables were impossible. Now really, Bell brought out the fact that this was problematic in 1966, and this extra assumption, this assumption was considered silly by Merman. I think the motivation for von Neumann was the fact that quantum mechanical expectation values satisfy this relationship. So the expectation value of C is equal to the expectation value of A plus the expectation value of B. So von Neumann kind of naturally presumed that the hidden value assignment, the value assignment, should satisfy the same relation. But notice that that's a much stronger condition to impose. I can imagine hidden variable assignments which have some statistical dispersion, so in time of parenthesis, some different hidden value assignments. And then the average of all those assignments might satisfy this relation. But in any individual case, the assignments don't. So he imposed a much stronger condition than what's required by quantum mechanics, and derived to kind of a trivial contradiction. Notice also that this would be true for, if you imagine quantum mechanics just revealing the direction of a spin vector when we measure a spin at a particle. This would be true, but so that's not what quantum mechanics is doing. So if we drop the third assumption, then we can construct more complex invariant models which are consistent with quantum mechanics. So Bella goes through this in 1966 and gives a very simple example of a hidden variable model for a spin half system. Probably the most celebrated example of a hidden variable model is the de Broglie theory. And that theory has an explicit non-local character. So you hear all about that when Shelley Goldstein comes in February and Anthony follows up in March with some lectures on de Broglie. But just for now, take it as given that it does have this explicit non-local character. And Bell was aware of that. And in fact, the non-locality of the de Broglie hidden variable model and the issue of locality and non-locality that comes up in the UPR argument led Bohm to ask a question, which was any hidden variable theory which reproduces statistical predictions of quantum theory have to have this non-local character? So now we'll turn to Bell's theorem. Is there any other questions about what it means to make these things? Some of the students have questions about.
That's what Bell's theorem is talking about? Whether
it has to be non-local. Whether non-locality is implicit. Yeah, we're going to go through it right now, actually. But does anyone understand the concept of assigning values to operators in a complete way? Is that clear? Okay.
I thought, I'm trying to remember, that someone had strengthened a lot of the theorem, so you only had to assume this additivity to community.
Yeah.
So that criticism.
There's a couple of papers, I think, Joff and Pyron, I don't know if pronounce their names. That's also commented on. In Bell's paper in 1966, he goes through a series of them and points how they have certain implicit assumptions. Which involved not treating operators, but I don't recall and what the analysis was. But it's in Bell's 1966 paper, it's discussion.
I thought that maybe Bell's theorem could be viewed as just a continuation of that sequence. And once you know that it works for commuting, it suffices to assume this additivity for commuting. Sense, you notice that if it's case like the definite in the locality, whatever you like to call it, and then you more or less arrive at inequality. I mean, there's a lot of insight.
Yeah, there's a way to derive the Bell's inequality using value assignments. There was a thing pointed out first by Lerman, maybe we'll touch on that at the end. So Bell considered basically the same, to illustrate this issue, or bring this issue to into question, he considered the same setup by the bulk half, the DPR setup. So we have two spin half particles. And we wanted to see if there was a restriction on the correlations that could be exhibited between these two systems, where the key idea was to not consider just measurements along the same axis, but measurements along different axes for the different systems, and study the correlation properties between the outcomes observed. So we imagine these two systems, it's called A and B. Let's call the results of the measurements capital A and capital B. And we allow these results to depend on some hidden variables, which would be completely unspecified and denote by lambda. They could be continuous, they could be discrete, there could be, So there's no restrictions placed on them. And we assume we have some experimental arrangement where the magnitude of the outcomes is bounded by one. They're both A and B. Now, the outcome at A, so little a and little b are the directions along which we make the measurement. There's some parameters characterizing the choice of measurement. Now, we allow the outcome at A to depend on the choice of measurement of system one. So we allow capital A to depend on little a. That's completely natural. And also these arbitrary variables, lambda, which characterize the state. we allow b to depend on little b and the same values lambda, which fully characterize the state. But we do not allow a to depend on the setting at the detector b. And we do not allow b to depend on the setting at the detector a. So this is the locality assumption. So this is mathematically what's required. So now we allow the parameters lambda to be arbitrary and described by some probability density rho. So rho of lambda is non-negative and normalized to 1. And we define a correlation function in the form defined by this integral. And now we allow the variable little a, the variables little a and little b to be different. So imagine different experiments, we repeat the same preparation, and the hidden values can be distributed differently each time we do the experiment. That's what rho specifies, and each time we do the experiment, lambda can assume different values. But we allow control over the directions of the measures, or the settings of the measures. So we consider actually two different settings, a and a prime at apparatus a, and b and b prime at apparatus b. And then I'm not going to go through the proof. Actually, you all have the pleasure of doing that for, as an exercise. And the inequality that Bell obtains is that the norm of this sum of the correlations has to be less than 2. So this just requires basic algebra. Now, what happens if we think of a quantum mechanical system which satisfies these conditions? So the conditions set out basically from here to here, which implies its conclusion. Well, we can consider a system of two spin half particles, actually arbitrary two-level systems, and we pair them in a singlet state, which is a coherent entangled superposition of being up and down with zero angular momentum, which we saw before. Now we can define the correlation function by considering the expectation value of a measurement of spin along the direction A for system A and along the direction little b for system B. And we have to include this normalization factor so that we have the right normalization. And then we go through some simple algebra. We define cos theta to be A dot B. And what we find is that the quantum mechanical correlation is equal to minus cos theta. Now, if we choose all the directions to be coplanar, and we choose A and B parallel, and define an angle between A and B prime, and A prime and B to be the same, and we call that angle phi, then the Bell inequality imposed on this observable correlation poses a constraint on phi. Well, constraint on this function of phi. And we can find it's violated for a wide range of angles phi. In fact, all angles from 0 to 90 degrees. So I didn't go through the math, so the students get to. So the first exercise for the next and second assignment is to derive the inequality. You can find this in two of Bell's papers, his 1906 paper, his 1971 paper, or lots of, I'm sorry, his 1964 paper, or lots of secondary treatments. Drive the inequality, calculate the correlation for the single state, quantum mechanical one, plot the quantum mechanical prediction, and show that it violates the bound imposed by Bell's. So what do we learn from this mathematical exercise? Well, first let's distinguish the kind of locality that's violated by quantum mechanics. And it's sometimes called weak locality. And the reason it's called weak locality is because it does not permit supraluminal signaling. So in other words, if I'm at detector B, and the person at detector A does some measurement, then I just get some random outcome. There's going to be some correlations between our outcomes, but the actual string of bits I get is just a random sequence of outcomes, no matter what detector setting that means. So there's no information in the sequence of measurement outcomes that I obtain. Later on, if I communicate with the other person, you can check if you violated Bell's inequalities or not. That requires communication, a conventional sort. So what we find from this is that we can't use it to actually causally influence the person that's connected to these correlations. But there is somehow an unexplained correlation there. It doesn't, and so if we could violate strong locality, as you can do, say, with rigid body mechanics, then we could use that to superlinearly signal. But in this case, we can't, and so we're only violating what's called weak locality based on this distinction. So that's a first kind of critical assumption. I mean, we're not going to have paradoxes of killing our grandmothers and things like that by because of these correlations. Second point to learn is that Bell's argument relied on an assumption of determinism. So the outcomes were determined by the hidden variable, as specified there. Later on, other researchers, Falkenhorn, Schmeling, and Holt, and Falkenhorn Form developed inequalities using local hidden variables. Using hidden variables and the locality constraint that the outcomes at A were independent of the parameter settings at B. That's actually mis-expressed. But they didn't have a deterministic assumption. They only had a probabilistic dependence. So the outcomes depended probabilistically on the hidden variables. And so we see that what's that question here, the problem isn't the fact that we assume the hidden variables to be deterministic, that we assume them to be local. They could assume local hidden variables. I don't know what I'm saying with that. That was correct.
Might be something that people would debate, but it starts, for example, about Bell's view. You said that he has an assumption, Bell's argument relies on an assumption of determinism. Now, Bell thought that he was producing determinism via the BPR argument, and then going on to, from that, to produce this inequality. And now Bell, in his book, in several places, he states and expresses some frustration because people don't understand this problem.
Okay.
So the way Bell presents it is that first you do the EPR argument. So you're going to say that if I make measurements along the same axis for both wings, then I can predict with certainty the outcome over there. Okay. Now, if you assume locality, then, okay, so in this situation, the outcome over there is determined, right? Now, if you assume locality, well, then whatever measurement I'm making here, that should still be determined. Because what happens over there shouldn't depend on what I do over here, if you assume locality. So Bell's argument is a two-part argument. If you assume locality, then you deduce that the outcomes over there are determined, okay? Then you go on to make an argument about the statistical correlations for different measurement axes are too strong. And I think in one of his papers he also has a version of the Bell inequality half of his argument, which doesn't even get to the variables, it's just about correlations. But it is true that almost everybody takes views, well, you know, there's an assumption of determinism, assuming variables. But certainly Bell himself thought that was quite wrong. And the determinism being inferred by the EPR argument from the problem.
So, okay, thanks for that observation.
So the thing is, in Bell's view, the assumption of locality is incompatible with quantum, regardless of the invariable.
Which was also illustrated by these later proofs.
Well, I've noticed something very interesting that if you have a set of hidden variables that are continuous, right? And when the system evolves, these variables must evolve, correct?
They can evolve. The theorem is consistent with them having a dynamics, but doesn't presuppose any.
It then suggests that the system is evolving for a continuous set of pure states. I mean, is there an assumption that these states are also pure, or can be pure?
Wait, didn't you say the states mean the hidden variable states or the
norm states? The hidden variable states. Is there an assumption that these are all pure states?
Pure in the sense of completely specifying outcomes? What do you mean by pure?
The way Bell's formulation theorem, he defines the hidden parameter to be defined at some initial time, say at the time that you compare. So the lambdas here, all the lambdas that you see appearing in the proofs, are specified at some initial time. Exam at later times to make measurements, and you know, it may well be that some particular theory, the actual values of lambda evolve over time. But what he calls lambda is lambda at the initial time.
They're defined, I guess, unbeknownst to you, obviously, but there should be a notion that these are accessible to some.
Well,
you can do it explicitly assuming they're not accessible to anyone.
I'm going to come to my final point here. If you do assume these are pure states, then you have a classical system essentially evolving through a continuum of pure states. And if you read Hardy's axiom, this is a quality only of quantum systems. If you can only evolve continuously through a continuum of pure states, then you are a quantum system. So I guess my point is just that perhaps that's...
Isn't Hardy just assuming a discrete classical phase space for that analysis? So he was considering that you have the permutation on discrete variables, he doesn't consider continuous positive variables.
And all the system looks
well,
at the finite.
Things that they don't yet exist,
the finite, not just discrete, finite.
The finite classical systems are always discrete.
But if you have an infinite system, which is a lambda like that, then you can have continuous evolution in the classical.
Hamilton's equations give a continuous evolution of pure classical states.
I'm sorry?
Hamilton's equations in motion give a continuous evolution of pure classical states as a counterexample to your point.
Well, I just think that there's something wrong with them. I guess I would say that there's no such thing as a continuous classical variable.
Granted, Bell asserted that this analysis doesn't depend on the assumption the variables are continuous,
yeah,
but I've never looked at how that pans out if you take a discrete assumption. But on Bell's authority, it doesn't matter. I don't know if anyone else is aware of work which is explicitly considered that. So it's important that the ultraviolet catastrophe is basically a transformation to continuous discrete that avoids the catastrophe.
I think you can see the distinction between the two. If you consider this initial state, it wasn't a single, then you wouldn't have perfect correlation. And then the assumption, and then the random versus deterministic assumption, which is very important, was actually irrelevant. I mean, you couldn't plus it. You couldn't. So we talk about using those that are
expressed upon the argument when you have a time to send all the traffic measurements and traffic signals.
Okay, there are a few more controversial points to raise. We're going to talk about free will for hopefully only a brief amount of time. So there's an assumption here that the detector settings can be chosen independently. So what does that mean? Well, we can imagine that the experimenters have free will, and so choose at random or according to their free will, whatever that process involves, the settings. Or we can imagine some pseudo-random function generator in each apparatus at the last minute choosing the detector setting, which I think is more or less what MAS space experiments used. A pseudo-random generator to choose the setting at the last moment, certainly outside of the influence, the special relativistic causal influence between the two measurements. But there are issues here that are conceptually troubling. So ultimately, if you want to consider a fully deterministic classical model of the world, then it's not clear how to reconcile that with that with this assumption of independent settings. But it is clear that there would have to be some massive conspiracy in the deterministic evolution of the universe, such that the settings were always chosen so as to violate Bell's inequalities. So that's something just kind of food for thought. I haven't spent too much time thinking about it, but it is an issue on the horizon of this subject. I don't know if anybody has thought about this more, was
that it doesn't have anything to do with hidden variables, right?
No, it has to do with the assumption of the driving inequality. So it's, I mean, the point is, we come to a rather dramatic conclusion, so we should take a careful look at all the assumptions that go into the derivation of Bell's inequality. Localities, you know, the most prominent one, but there are others, one of which is this independence notion. And so this, yeah?
Assumption that there's no backwards causation.
I'm not going to use that.
So the phenomenon of this assumption was just to recognize, or assuming that the values of these hidden parameters that are time zero do not depend on the set you would have made time. So in other words, if later on you shift your setting, then there isn't some signal going backwards in time from those settings and changing the values of the parameters.
Okay.
That's also a
you're raising the possibility that the signals could go backwards,
yeah.
It's still not Facebook.
I mean, people, there are people who try to make theories along those lines.
Okay. So now, what's the rub, so to speak? So what you'll often hear is this idea that, well, look, we can forget about hidden variables. Bell shows there are no hidden variables because they have to be non local. That's absurd. Therefore, hidden variables are absurd. That's a very misleading argument. It's true that Bell's inequalities do show us that hidden variable models that reproduce quantum theory have to have this non-local character. But let's suppose then, as a result of that, we reject hidden variable models. We reject the idea that there exists some further specification of systems properties. And we assume instead that the quantum state is a complete description of the physical properties. Well, the EPR analysis shows us, implicitly, not explicitly, that because quantum states have to be updated for consistency with the correlated outcomes, non-locally, it follows that the physical properties of the world, i.e. the quantum states, are exhibiting non-locality. So it's like a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, where you think the quantum states are complete, you have to deal with some kind of non-locality. If you think quantum states are not complete, you have to deal with some kind of non-locality. In fact, some people argue that I think the Bell scenario includes the orthodox von Neumann-Dirac interpretation as a special case. So one can think of the state itself as being the extent of the hidden variables. And in that sense, what we deduce here from the EPR analysis is contained within the Bell's inequalities result. But that's not crystal clear to me, so I won't try and reproduce it or defend it. But in any case, one has this argument. And then other authors, in particular Staff, and I think Anthony was telling me that Bell makes this point himself, but I couldn't track it down. But if we just think about the sequences of experimental outcomes which violate Bell inequalities, that these sequences imply non-locality of the future of the world, kind of independently of any other considerations. Is that a fair characterization? Or
what yeah, I think it's in. So it's Bell himself develops an EPR argument that is, I think, more clear and in Einstein's EPR argument. But that's just in the beginning of the theory. He begins with this argument and say that, look here, quantum theory doesn't satisfy this particular locality. And then he goes on to say that, oh, maybe way out would be complete for the previous place would be a little bit, it's not local, according to this.
So the conclusions we have to draw are much stronger than people tend to, which is that this is somehow just a result of dismissals in variables. I mean, the crux of this is that non-locality runs deep. In any theory which is going to reproduce these experimental results and violate Bell's inequalities. So the rub is then we shouldn't see this as a reason to reject hidden variables, but as a required constraint of an hidden variable model. So let me just add that experiments have been done on Bell type inequalities, and they have demonstrated experimentally a violation of the inequalities. A number of experiments, the most kind of noteworthy review for the experiments by LAS fan coworkers, where in at least one of those series experiments, I know they were switching the detector settings kind of pseudo-randomly and at the last minute, such that there could be no kind of causal influence between them in any standard notion, and did find a violation. There are issues that come up about the fact we don't have perfect detection of particles and whether or not there are loopholes because of that detector inefficiency. In any case, there's a lot there to cover. LAS Fay is coming to visit us in March, the 15th and 17th. We'll be giving two lectures on Bell. We'll be going through the Bell argument and talk about the kind of survey of experimental tests that we've done. So that next topic is going to be contextuality. So are there any kind of lingering issues that questions anybody has about non-locality and how to understand it? Yeah.
Can I ask about, you mentioned earlier the idea of having both advanced and retarded interactions. Would we call that local theory, just in general, if we have both advanced and retarded interactions? So suppose it turns out that I have, like, the output of my experiments is moving backwards. Such a way that we still have light coming through in both directions, but we have a super looking one, like a retarded or interactions.
You might argue that that is an event on the theory. I suppose maybe one example, if you have a theory where all of these effects are going along the lectern or get back, some people like that because they think then I don't have to change the structure of space and I can carry on with the possible space and I have to try and develop theory on that background. But whereas, you know, if you're having effects propagating space-like effects, then you might worry about, well, do I need to refer to gray or do I need to change the structure of space? But I think it's true, even in the case where there's a composite structure with effects on the light part, you might argue, in a real sense, it's still not local. Find it in a way that it's still on the cosmic space.
But we have our attack locality comes mostly out of the success of the that's why I would say, well, if we have local, we go out of life. I mean,
Newtonian physics
is non-local, and although I remember Newton saying if he wasn't fully satisfied with the mechanism, people weren't really bothered by the fact that this is not local, but now we are because the assumption of locality brings us into theories that are very successful. But those theories are still compatible with the advanced and retarded interaction combination. So if we did something like that, we could explain why this happened and yet retain our satisfaction of locality from why we're attach this idea from the success. That's the case. Yeah. I think that's
I think probably you have to worry about it. I mean, it's one obvious worry in general is that you can sense the space, direction, you can send both backwards and forwards, back and there and then go there. So if you have so the theory of adding its treatments to
you might
be able
to go
together, then it's very clearly very difficult. So if you want, you will have a chance of claiming this in some sort of local theory, but at least have some stories of why signals can't be strong again. I'm not saying it's possible to try such a story, but...
No. You raise an interesting one. I was just wondering about whether if you could have some theory that in some sense explain why we developed all the food for suffering with family, but still work this way to get around it.
Yeah.
Just kind of stay on the same topic. I mean, the other problem you're going to have when you try to take one of these back in time causation theories, which you look as if they preserve structure space time, and turn that from a nice toy model that's here into a sort of full blown banana thing, which is that it's very clear how you go out and writing down the dynamics for that. The way we used to write the dynamics is going to be put all the stuff on a slice, write down what's going on some spatial slice or some very thin slice of space time. Then the theory will tell you what happens most of the time, and probabilistically maybe a little thing will happen. But when your theory makes it sort of put on my data, I have all the forward tracking it, oh look, now the stuff gets on the thing that actually occurs to me, forward tracking this other thing. Then you're placing the sort of dynamics you're going to have is going to look something very different from what we know we're going to have. Particularly if this sort of thing's fairly big, which it's not like there's one wormhole in our universe, which you've got to take kind of the whole form of kind of product and put it down. So I mean, it's like maybe something that could be done, but we don't identify anything that's remotely like the level of an actual plausible theory, not just an idea. So,
Let me curtail discussion on this topic because we have a little more to cover here. Namely, this idea of contextuality, which is important. So this is the topic I probably know the least about of what we've covered, but luckily there's some experts in the very US who will catch me if I say anything stupid. Okay, so let's consider again this idea that quantum states represent incomplete knowledge of some pre-existing values. For observables. And then the idea is that we'll actually construct some assignment, like we discussed in the context of von Neumann's no-go theorem. We want to consider the possibility of assignments to operators. That is, we have some function v, which possibly, depending on the state of psi, assigns a value, a real value, to an operator A, a Hermitian operator A, for observable. So, what kinds of requirements can we impose on these assignments? We saw that von Neumann imposed two strong requirements and the trivially derived an impossibility. But there's more innocent requirements we can impose. One of them is that we take a set of commuting operators, A, B, C. We would like that, which can be assigned, that we measure simultaneously. We can have a consistent set of outcomes for the measurements of these operators. And we can expect that a function of the values for each of these operators should be the same as the value of the operator representing the function of those operators. So this is what you would expect, for example, this is the case for the eigenvalues of the operator. Now this implies a few properties more directly. One is that linear combinations of commuting operators, that's an example of this function, products of the operators have to satisfy in relation to. And another important property is that the identity operator has to be assigned one, value one. So what does this tell us in terms of more familiar things? Well, remember we talked about the spectral decomposition. Let's consider a non-degenerate observable A with eigenvalues lambda k and projectors p. Projectors are projectors up to the eigenstates, phi k of the operator. Projector satisfies the fact that p squared is equal to p. So from these, we can deduce that the value assignments to projectors have to be either 0 or 1. We can think of the identity as a sum over a complete set of projectors. Valuation of the identity has to be 1. Projectors are orthogonal. So at least one of the values has to be 1 and the rest has to be 0. And then from this it follows directly that because of the spectral decomposition, that the values assigned to an operator A have to be one of those eigenvalues. This is again what you might expect, given that the eigenvalues are what are revealed upon measure. So that seems innocent enough as an assumption of what we can do, how we can further specify quantum mechanics. Bell showed. I'm just going to state the theorem, and then I'll show you the result by Merman. That if the Hilbert space dimension is greater than 2, a consistent value assignment constrained, as according to the rules we just discussed, is not possible. So we can't think of all of these operators we measure, even a commuting set, as having well-defined properties in advance. Well, not just a commuting set. The sets of commuting sets. So let me just explain a bit what the original Bell-Cocker spectral theorem was, and then we'll give an example from Merman. So Bell got a result as a corollary of Gleason's theorem. Kojin and Specker obtained the result. So Bell's approach seems to assume a continuum of projectors, whereas the Kojin and Specker theorem required only a finite set, actually 117 vectors in a three-dimensional space. and they considered sets of triads. So you can imagine a three-dimensional space, we have three basis vectors, which are orthogonal, and therefore they commute, and we can assign values to them. But any given triad, I can construct another triad which shares, say, the same z-axis, shares the same z-axis, but has different directions in the xy plane. So we have two triads which all commute with each other, and the shared element that commutes, but the additional elements in the xy plane don't commute with each other. So this follows from the fact that if we have operators A, B, and C, A and B commute, B and C commute, not necessarily that A and C commute. Okay, these proofs require are slightly technical, so I won't get into them. But what we'll do is illustrate, I just give you a kind of taste of what was going on in the original Velikov and Spector theorems. But there's a very simple example in a four-dimensional Hilbert space from Mohman, which I'm going to go through now in detail. But before I do that, do you guys want to add anything about the original ones? Any offhand comments? Yeah?
It's worth mentioning that the Bell theorem, the Borellian example, and I can do this measurement, together with two systems, and I can do this measurement, or I can do that measurement. Now, the Bell theorem tells you that the outcome over here has to depend on which of these measurements are going to be. So, I mean, that's an example of if you said, well, these are commuting observed, spin here and spin here, commuting observed. Okay, so I can measure A and B, or I can measure A and C. These two don't commute. Now, if I assume that the outcome here does not depend on which measurement, well, then you get a contradiction term. So, contextuality is a sort of more general example that I might have a single system where I can measure two commuting observables, say A and B, or I can measure A and C. Okay, where B and C don't commute, but A and B commute, A and C commute. So, if you're this at the same time or that at the same time, the question is, does this outcome depend on which of these other measurements I'm doing? And this theorem tells you that, well, so we're not sure in general.
So what you're doing there is you're using locality to derive a non-contextuality assumption.
Right.
And then you get a contradiction.
Yeah.
So, right. So, but so contextuality is so clearly the culprit in the contradiction, right?
Yeah.
Well,
I think but you can argue, I mean, in this case, you said you've got a physical reason for assuming non-contextuality.
Yeah, there are close connections there.
And just to follow up, this is entirely correct. But the only distinction between the two cases is that the derivative by prediction of the spin and a half case, the spin and a half, you need to invoke probability. In other words, what you contradict is some statistical correlation, some pattern of statistical correlation. And then you can ask, well, is there something wrong with my measure theory? I mean, people have suggested that, well, some non-standard measure theory, something like this, whereas in these quantum Spector type theorems, what you're contradicting is sort of big logic without worrying about probability. Or if you like, probability is a special case. Everything is 1 and 0.
Yeah, that's true. So it's been worth emphasizing that these value assignments we're considering are essentially hidden variables. They've got pre-existing values, which would be revealed upon measurement. So that's the kind of conceptual connection there. So, so this last example from Mohman, which is very, very easy to follow. So if I can find a page, we can go through. So it just deals with Pauli operators. So we have a four-dimensional Hilbert space. And we have two Pauli operators. So here the subscripts refer to axes. superscripts refer to part of some rich part. So that's our setup. Now we consider the following square. Now, the first thing I notice is that each row and each column finds a set of commuting operators. So sigma x particle 1 commutes sigma x particle 2. So these commute all commute with each other. Similarly for y, and similarly, this case is not as obvious. What we have is that sigma x, well, this one, right, the only issue here is sigma x and sigma y anti-commute, so how does this work? So it's the anti-commutation. Right, so let's check out sigma x1. Sigma y2. Sigma x2. Sigma y1. We have sigma x1 times sigma y1 sigma y2 times sigma x2 minus sigma x1 minus sigma x2 sigma y1 sigma x1 sigma y2. And then sigma x1 sigma y1 is equal to sigma z1 times I. Sigma y, sigma x2, sigma x2 is equal to minus I times sigma z2. These are the simple identity poly operators. Sigma x2 times sigma y2 is equal to I, sigma z2. Sigma y, sigma x is equal to minus 1 times I, z2. So we have the same quantity on the right and left. So it's equal to 0. So similarly, we can show that the elements of each row commute with each other, and elements of each column also commute with each other. So sigma x1, any operator on particle 1 commutes with an operator on particle 2. Sigma x1 commutes with itself. Sigma sigma y2, and so forth. So it's an easy exercise to verify that each of these sets defined by the rows and columns are a commuting set. And now we're going to assume the fact that the value of a function sum a, b, c has to be equal to a function of the values assigned to a. Something that would be necessary. But so in the case of the function of A, B, and C will be the product of each of these in the row and column. So what we have is that we multiply all these, so now what we do is we multiply the operators in each row and each column. The first row, we have sigma x1 times sigma x2 times sigma x1 times sigma x2. We use the fact that sigma x1 squared is equal to identity. Similarly for sigma x2, so the product is identity. So the value for the first row for the product has to equal to 1. Similarly, for the second row, the value has to equal to 1 for the product. And x here is the node product. And then which one is the culprit? Right. This one also, the product of the row is equal to 1. And for the columns, we can verify that the function of the operators, the product of the operators, has to have value 1. Value of the product is equal to 1, except for the third column. In the third column, we consider the product, I'll write it out, we have sigma x1 times sigma x2. Each column and row defines a commuting set, so the order doesn't matter. Times sigma y1, sigma y2, sigma z1, sigma z2. What's this product? Well, sigma x1 times sigma y1 is equal to I sigma z1. Sigma x2 times sigma y2 is equal to I sigma z2. And we have sigma z1 and sigma z2. Sigma z squared is equal to identity, sigma z for both. So we have minus 1 as identity. So the value of this column is equal to minus 1 by using this assumption. And the rule that the value of identity is equal to 1. Now, actually, I don't even think we need this part of the equation, but just for completeness, let me mention that for any poly operator, sigma mu I, the allowed values are 1 and minus 1, which are the eigenvalues. So we can evaluate. Sorry for my V's and sigmas aren't always as distinct as they should be. So, well, we've derived this as an impossibility. Because if we consider, now here's the trick. Now we consider the product of the rows. The product of the rows has to be plus 1. So v of the function for row 1 times v of the function for row 2 times v of the function for row 3 has to equal to plus 1. But the valuation for column 1 times the valuation for column 2 times the valuation for column 3 has to equal minus 1. The third column valuation is minus 1 because they have minus the identity of the product. But this is impossible. So what we found is that the way we state the significance of this impossibility theorem is that a non-contextual assignment of values is not possible. So the idea being, if I want to specify what sigma x is, maybe it's better illustrated by, right, if I want to specify what sigma x is, its value, then I have to tell you whether or not I'm considering its valuation within the context of this commuting set or within the context of this commuting set. If I try to do it for both simultaneously, try to have some kind of consistent assignment for both sets, then it fails. It's logically impossible. So this is the central idea of the fact that we have a contextual evaluation assignments only for hidden variables. So any hidden variable model has to be not only non-local, but also contextual. And as Anthony emphasized, there's a connection between the two. There are ways to understand how one implies the other. So that's what I conclude there. Let me just mention some quotes, and then we can open up for discussion. Any questions people have? So Bell was a little bit discontent with his results. So his kind of self-criticism was you tacitly assume that the measurement of an observable must yield the same value independently of what other measurements must be made simultaneously. That was the non-textuality assumption, which led to a contradiction. Since some observables, each set, which is row or column in Nerman's proof, or triads in the original Kochan-Specker proof, do not commute with the additional observables in the other set, the measurements of each complete set are incompatible. This was kind of summarizing what Bell was saying. And then, quote, these different possibilities require different experimental arrangements. There is no a priori reason to believe that the results should be the same. And so here we have kind of an illustration of Bohr's ideas that the measuring instruments, really the complete measurement apparatus, serves to define the condition under which the phenomena appear. So if we want to talk about reality in quantum mechanics, we have to really fully specify everything we're doing. We're the complete set of computing operators we're measuring. Then I can give you a valuation assignment that doesn't lead into difficulties. Though it might have these non-locality issues from the point of view of contextuality, kind of all that's the issue. So I have one last transparency for some course-related stuff about reading material for next week. But before that, let's talk about actuality a bit. Okay.
So for the locality part, there was a statement that if you want to make a hidden value of field, they also have to be non-local. There's a non-local constraint for that. Is there an analogous thing for contextuality? If you want to make a hidden variable theory, the hidden variables have to somehow be contextual?
Yeah, I'm not sure how to
address
that.
Or the sums or the traits of that?
Well, in the way I think it's simple, so you call it hidden variables different. What does that mean? It means you've got some mapping from these initial parameters to outcome. So say you're measuring this observable A, then your outcome A is going to be some function of the initial parameters. Okay? Now, contextuality simply says that that mapping also has to depend on which other observable you're measuring at the same time. So in other words, mapping from lambda to A has to, you can't describe A as a function of lambda. A is a function of lambda and of what other observables are being measured. In other words, the mapping depends on the experimental arrangement. So, which again is just like in the locality example, where the mapping from lambda to the outcome here has to depend on the distance set. Okay? So similarly here, like in these spin measurements, so the outcome, I mean, you might, let's say you're considering a particular, I don't know, sigma x particle one, okay? You've got some mapping from lambda to the outcome. That mapping has to contain an index which specifies whether the experiment is the experiment you would do to measure the column or the experiment you would do to measure the row. That's what you have.
And isn't there a certain counterfactuality at play here in the sense that I'm either going to do an experiment to measure the row, or I'm going to do a measurement to measure the column?
Yeah.
And so in a sense, the contradiction is between different possibilities, not simultaneously actual. And so there's that kind of...
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're different experimental arrangements, just like changing the setting in the EPR over there's a different experimental arrangement.
We're also talking about deterministic theory, and we have the value assignments. The deterministic theory were allowed to do these counterfactual statements. Just take Newtonian theory, you're allowed to contemplate what would happen if I did that, but I didn't, right? So if you assume the terms, the counterfactual statements are not going to be possible.
We don't necessarily want to assume determinism, though. No.
Okay.
We don't necessarily want to assume determinism.
Exactly. But on this type, you have value assignments for vectors. So that about value assignment means some deterministic vectors. Because if you didn't have it, you could not be able to know this.
Let me try and answer to the question. Which I think is similar to what Fuzzy and Anthony were saying. I think the broader problem is with contextuality or non-contextuality. What all these things prove is that you have some sort of context throughout the language you do. Which means, just to restate it, that if you, the results you get with one measurement may depend on what other measurement you're doing along with it. So you might just say, well, that's just a feature of the world. The connection with locality, or what I would refer to as relativistic causality, comes when you imagine those two measurements to be in space like separated regions. Then you have a very good reason to want systematic construction. But these same mathematical theorems, of course, you should do it. So I think any one of these non-contextual results can be converted into a non-quote locality result by introducing some kind of pair of correlated system. So just in the case of this Hermann example, if you take a third spin and a half, then it becomes a non-locality proof of value. Or the original Copenhagen one, if you introduce a second spin one half, spin one, a second spin one part, and you have a pair of spin one parts, again, it converts into the kind of argument the Dahl type, but without requiring a probability. Then you're going to get a logical contribution.
Right. So let me mention the students that for the term projects, Ray and I mentioned some last Tuesday. I think what would be two very good term projects would be looking into the different inequalities that have been demonstrated over the years, the relative inequalities, CHSH, and so on. And for a separate topic, we need to look into contextuality proofs, and or a third topic, we need to look at the relationship between them. I think they'll be very good projects, very challenging projects, but they would certainly be interesting to mark. So I would encourage that. Let me just add one last note. So next week we have Many Worlds. David Wallace is here. He'll be lecturing for us. He's recommended a few papers you can read. So there's Everton Structure, which is on the archive, probability of objective uncertainty, also on the archive. People are particularly keen, which is of course all of you, should also look at the Many Worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. Available on this website, and in Mechanics Against the Many Worlds Interpretations, also available on the archives. And then for those of you who need a full understanding of decoherence, take a look at Zurich's paper, which was recommended by David. Okay, well, that's it. So is there any other, let me just finish off with some questions. David?
Just take a very quick question about those readings. I think the technical thing that you need to report, we need to have a good one to understand the end interpretation, is details. So that means that's high priority in the order.
Oh,
so if by some, it doesn't need to be that particular thing for details. If you don't think you understand what's going on with details, then read something out in details in advance. I'll talk about a bit, but.
Well, we've covered details in some conceptual detail.
Right, so you've got.
And you show how it works, but it's good to have some exercise under the belt. The assignment will be issued online today. The website Ray gave you, and that has two problems on calculating decoherence, which is density matrices, so that'll help.
It's sufficient setting.
And so your lectures are at 15.
I'm a bit confused in February with what you said about performing measurements along with it, and that will define the outcome of this measurement. Because if we have three commuting observables, say A, B, and C, then what I understand is that when you say that they commute, is that I can perform them at the same time, I can perform measurement A, then sometime after measurement B, and then sometime after measurement C, or first C, for them again, and A. And so if the outcome of measurement A is depends on whether at a later time I will measure B or a B prime.
If B and C not commute. For A and B to commute, for A and C to commute, but B and C to commute. So you can either measure A and B or measure A and C.
Yeah, so I mean, in this example,
if I measure the column, or I measure a row, these are all sets of three commuting
materials,
right? And you're telling me that the measurement of A,
the
observables in the column, you don't commute with observables in the row.
Right.
You can't do both of those experiments at the same time.
No. But what I'm saying is, imagine you either perform the measurements in the column, or you perform the measurements in the
right.
row. So all three observables are commuting with each other. But from what I'm understanding from this, if you wanted to have a hidden variable interpretation of this, the value of my first measurement would depend on whether I chose at a later time to do the column measurements or the row measurements.
So this is wrong. There's no way you can prove that there. You can prove that somewhere that you have such dependence. If you ask quantum mechanics, I mean, I will have such a dependence for this row and for that column. You can't do it. But somewhere in the diagram you have a convergence. You can't locate that row.
Let me try and so what he's saying is it doesn't have to be a backwards, it could be a forward in time thing. Okay,
so
just that it,
yes. So if you write out the times of doing the measurement in that square though, and using the assumption that things cannot fit backwards in time, you can locate where the type of computation was. So what I'm saying is there's no way you can prove from quantum mechanics that the correlation will be there, that the sigma x, the first one, left, will actually depend on that point. You cannot prove that. But somewhere in there will be such a conflict that is, there will be an operator that is dependent on the conflict.
So you cannot conclude that every single observable has this conflict, but for at least one of them somewhere is going to happen.
I'm so confused because in essence you're doing an excessive search.
You have the same situation. You cannot prove that the value of this measurement here will depend on shifting the angle over here, or the value of this thing is depending on the angle over here. You cannot prove that. But together with all this menu of AA prime, BB prime, you can prove that. As somewhere,
you can't have no locality in one direction. You can't prove that it has to be in both directions. So if you get similarly there too, you can think about, well, what if I measure this spin and later I measure that spin? How is that later experiment going to measure what happened with Feldman? But again, Feldman should at least in one direction, it has to be in the end.
So there's a learning state from my conclusion paper. There is this comment about time learning. And this is the answer, but he doesn't give it. He cannot learn it. And he uses this argument in time learning to say that the only natural reason for a univariable theory to be to have the any univariable theory must be non-potential, that is a natural thing. But he just omits this issue that he cannot locate where the complex dependence is.
The simplest way of framing these discussions is to assume that the three observables communities, which are the three tubes, are all measured at the same time. Mm-hmm. If you do that, then it's fine. And the reason why you want to do that is there's an end to these spins that you can measure them at successive times. You can imagine with a hidden variable theory, you can just say that it's A, and then the hidden variables change after you measure A, so it's something else. And so you get into a more complicated discussion there because you've got dynamics of hidden variables. So if you want to avoid the discussion, just stick to the simplest scenario that you can measure at the same time. Then you worry it doesn't apply, and then it will go to the rest of the
thing. I think the issue is significant. Why don't you could translate it as why can we not send signals using the correlation, the alleged non-locality that's present in the Bell and the APR situation? But I think what he's worried about is take Anthony's case where you have A over here and B and C over here. You're claiming, it is being claimed, that whether you choose to measure B or whether you choose to measure C over here actually influences the outcome that you get over here measuring A. Is that not then, or why is it not incompatible with our belief that when we measure commuting observables, we don't have any effect with one group measurement that doesn't affect? I think that's the issue. I think it's a very subtle, but I mean, there is this very peculiar thing that in quantum mechanics you cannot detect the fact that you chose to measure B or C. Here is a measurement of A. Nevertheless, we're claiming, or this argument is claiming that in some sense, the choice you did over here did influence the reasoning. But in an individual case, the claim is that it influences the result, or it influences the result that you would have got over here had you measured A prime, which is an even more confusing thing, since you haven't measured A.
So these questions are focused on theory, and that theory, since it's deterministic, is fully capable of answering questions like, well, would I have been out of common and so on. So that, I think, is a key thing. Of course, in reality, we wonder. So I think this issue about counterfactual definiteness is blown out of the problem.
Counterfactual definiteness.
You were referring to the measurement that wasn't performed and so on. But I don't think that's a real issue.
Well, the time is running late, so maybe we'll have to continue this discussion in a different format. But so that will conclude today's lecture, and that concludes the introductory material. And next week, get ready for Ready Worlds. Thanks for your attention.